Dame Harriet Walter is known to the world as the basilisk-faced mother of Logan Roy's appalling brood of children, but she was famous, acclaimed, and awarded long before Succession's first season in 2018. In Britain and from time to time on Broadway, Harriet Walter is recognised as one of the finest Shakespearean actors of her generation. Now, I can't say this list is complete, and I know she'll correct me if I'm wrong, but she's played Cleopatra, Imogen, Portia, Lady Macbeth, wait for it, Prospero, Brutus, Henry IV, Ophelia, and, playing the saxophone at the age of 18, Mistress Quickly, something I need to ask her about in a moment. Though she acknowledges Shakespeare is, and I quote her, the poet of all our humanity, Harriet Walter has come to feel he never gave women their due. So she has, in her latest book, she speaks what Shakespeare's women might have said. It is outrageous and funny and wise. It's a meditation on Shakespeare, the thesis on acting, and a ghost memoir of its author, Harriet Walter. Harriet, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for that introduction.
It was a bit long, wasn't it? Went on.
I loved it. I could have heard more.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, look, I'll rev up and do a bit more later. Your first Shakespeare. How old were you when you were taken to a theatre and you saw Shakespeare?
I saw Judi Dench playing Juliet, and I would have been 9, something like that. And then I saw Vanessa Redgrave in As You Like It. And I have very vivid memories of the women, those two women. Don't remember much else about anything else. I remember people's voices and I remember the set, but I had no clue what the story was.
Had you kind of come to the notion that you were going to be an actor?
Funnily enough, you've just put two memories together, because my first sort of knowing pronouncement that I was going to be an actress was around that time, now I come to think of it, but not as a result of seeing Judi Dench in a proper play, but seeing Hayley Mills in The Parent Trap on screen. That's what did it for me. But funnily enough, you've just put, I suppose I was at the same sort of age. I didn't tie up what Judi Dench was doing on stage with what I wanted to do, which was I just wanted to be watched by a lot of people and escape and pretend to be somebody else. And that's not quite what she was doing.
I get the sense that the role that made all the difference for you was playing Ophelia when you were about 30?
Yeah, I guess I was there.
Why was that a sort of, it seemed a big step through the door into big theatre?
I think what had happened was I was gently slid into Shakespeare rather than having some great big sudden mountain to climb, because I'd just done a television film written by Ian McEwan, directed by Richard Eyre, about a young woman who was sort of going a bit potty because she knew too much during the war, and she was imprisoned for the duration because she'd sort of stepped out of line in a very secret atmosphere, which was necessary during the war, and very patriarchal world where she wasn't able to express herself. And so there I was playing this part, and Richard Eyre was about to direct Jonathan Pryce's Hamlet at the Royal Court, and he was thinking, I wonder who should play Ophelia. I've got her sitting here in front of me, because the character was rather similar. So having just played this sort of character...
What was the name of the film?
It was called The Imitation Game, long before the big movie that Benedict Cumberbatch and people did. Mm-hmm. But because it was in the same territory. It was about the sort of Bletchley people and Turing and all those people. It was sort of on that theme. It's an interesting piece. But anyway, what I mean is that I didn't, because it was the same director and some of the cast were the same, it felt like an easing into the world of Shakespeare. And also it was the Royal Court. It wasn't the Old Vic or the RSC. It was the Royal Court, which I'd worked in before. I don't know, it just felt less scary than it could have been.
But you write about working out for yourself a kind of backstory for Ophelia, fleshing out her life in your own mind, but not letting on to the audience about any of that, holding it in.
Yeah. I mean,
what's that about?
I didn't know how to rehearse. You know, this was my first big cheese production in the middle of London and with proper actors that were famous. And, you know, I'd spent 5 or 6 years on the fringe doing political theatre and experimental theatre and running around England in a van and putting the set up that night and taking it down at the end of the evening with people all of my age group and my peer group, none of us famous. And then
David Hare writes about that kind of van theatre. It wasn't anything to do with the playwright David Hare, was it?
Well, David Hare was a director of Joint Stock, along with William Gaskell and Max Stafford Clarke, who go on to be big cheeses, but at the time they weren't big cheeses.
Well, you're going on to be a big cheese yourself, but it's as Ophelia working out this whole life for her.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I didn't dare put it in front of anybody else. Rehearsals are the most scary bit about acting because you're getting it wrong in front of your peer group or your betters within your peer group. And you're getting it wrong because by definition, rehearsing means you do it wrong a lot of times before you do it right. And by the time you get in front of an audience, you've worked out how to do it and someone's patted you on the back and said you're in the right direction. But when you're rehearsing, you haven't a clue where you're going. And I'd never rehearsed in a company like that. And so, plus, we only had in those days, believe it or not, something like 3.5 weeks rehearsal. And if the bulk of it is dealing with Jonathan Pryce playing Hamlet, you're not going to get a lot of time practicing your few scenes. Sort of once a week, you'd come in and do a bit. And the rest of the time, out of sheer terror, I was working something up at home because I had to have something going on. And then she has this mad scene where she's talking nonsense and you've got to work out what that nonsense means. But the thing about acting is you're not supposed to demonstrate, you're supposed to just inhabit and let other people read you if they can. It was my first practice in that of knowing exactly what was going on inside my head. And if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't, you know, to the audience. And it's a good feeling. It's a good feeling having a secret from the audience.
And 1 or 2 years down the track, you've put these stories into verse in a book, the things that Shakespeare didn't write.
That's right. I love the 1 or 2. It's more like 5 decades.
And it is enormously funny and also satisfying. I mean, tell us about Gertrude, the real life of Gertrude. Now I finally understand it. I never really understood what a dreadful position that woman was in.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's still up for grabs. I'm not tying anything up. Come on, everyone's going to be able to chuck this out the window if they read it and say, well, that's one interpretation of zillions, because that's the way it works. But I just watch so many Gertrudes floundering on stage, not having any lines to come back at this sort of overgrown teenager.
Mr. Hamlet,
who's sort of really very immature, still blaming his parents for everything and women in general for most things, and not coming to terms with himself and yet being absolutely brilliant. Of course, he's a wonderful character as well, but he's that mixture. And the way he behaves with his mother is a spoilt child, really, is sort of... and he accuses her of, you know, how can you possibly fall in love with that ghastly man, my uncle, only a few months after you've wept at my father's funeral and, you know, that wonderful man who was my father. And she says he wasn't wonderful at all. You know, you've got it all wrong. You've got it back to front.
He was a beast.
Yeah, me and Claudius were in love ages and ages before anything happened. And your parents forced me to marry the older brother. And neither, we didn't like one another. We didn't get on. We produced you and then full stop. And, you know, he was a martinet and, absolutely impossible man. And of course, I can't tell you that. You know, when I say what Shakespeare's women might have said, it's also what they can't say sometimes. But she can't say it to him because it would break his hard to learn that this idol was actually rather awful and violent.
And so there it is in your book. She speaks, and it's the backstories that you give to these characters. And as I say, they're extraordinarily, they're funny, but they're also very wise. I love the fact that you found Cleopatra rather a bore. Why?
She's just a narcissist, really, and she can't really function unless she's got an audience. So she's either got the audience that's out there, you know, the real rabble at the Globe Theatre or whatever, but she's also got all her servants on stage and you know, obviously Roman soldiers and people she's impressed over the years, and Antony himself, and he's almost writing a piece about a theatrical couple who know about their own importance and know about their star quality.
And live
quality.
In public.
They live in public and they have star quality, and their reputation and their image is what's at stake. And of course I'm reducing it, you know, but the there is an element whereby they have a sense of their own grandeur and a sense of their, you know, they belong in the panoply of the stars in heaven, you know, and their lives are consequential, you know, what they do is sort of reverberates around the world. So they've got massive, massive egos, and they actually don't spend very much time on stage together. And when they do, they're usually shouting at one another and annoying one another and trying to bring back the past, but it's gone.
And when Cleopatra and Antony are reunited, Harriet, you've got the book in front of you.
Yes.
Cleopatra's rather disillusioned speech when she finds herself in heaven with Antony. Mm-hmm. I think we should have a burst of that, don't
Let's
you?
Let's give her a burst. I must say, when I was a child and people said you went to heaven, I thought, how boring.
It's always been a bit boring,
white,
hasn't it?
And empty and white clouds.
It's perhaps better than hell, though.
I suppose so. I'd rather just die, actually.
Give us a burst of Cleopatra.
Okay. It's called Another Dreary Day in Heaven. How tedious this eternity can be in close proximity with Antony, who once crossed mighty oceans in his stride, now curls up safe and cozy by my side. In life I longed for him, but now, oh hum, as Cressid rightly said, things won are done. What's love bereft of parting's sweetest sorrow, without the fear of losing him tomorrow? My asp bite and his wounds are long since healed, and all our fruits and grapes come ready peeled. Without command and sway and sexual sizzle, it's all one dreary democratic drizzle. This endless flowing cloudscape is so bland. My monument has crumbled into sand. Death killed my rule, but not my self-regard. Without an audience, I find life hard. I miss the thrill of being center stage, where slaves and emperors cowered at my rage, where nature's peaks and troughs, its fires and floods, reflected all the grandeur of my moods. Now, from my cloudy cushion, I survey Earth's pygmy players acting out a play in which I am portrayed as sly and willful, not as I was, politically skillful. As I predicted, squeaking Cleopatras parade my shame with shambling, hammy partners pretending to be Antony and fail to match our mythic stature and our scale. My pride and reputation are at stake. It took some guts to suckle that damn snake. I cannot bear to watch as wanton boys belittle my brave death with bendy toys. This Mr. William Shakespeare, who is he that he will dare to make a fool of me?
I'm talking to Harriet Walter about her new book, She Speaks, What Shakespeare's Women Might Have Said. Harriet, can I defend Shakespeare for a moment? Mm. I mean, can I give it a go? He wrote wonderful parts for women.
He did.
He understood women.
Yep.
And yet, you've got it in for him about women. I mean, think of the women that he has created, and yet you count the lines, you count the scenes, and there aren't enough of either.
Okay, let me make my position clear. He didn't write less well for women. He wrote astonishingly beautifully for women. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gone on doing it all this time. He understood women because he understood humanity. And when he talks, when women talk about war or fear or love or distress or jealousy or excitement, he's out, you know, there's nothing to parallel him. The only quarrel I have is not with Shakespeare, but with the times he was living in, where women didn't get to motor the engine of the plot, either on stage or off. And plots were built around men. And women were in the story in as much as they were related to the men. I challenge you to find a female character who isn't the mother, wife, daughter, or sister of any other character. It's quite difficult to find, unless you're a servant or something like that, or maybe the nurse in Romeo and Juliet. There are, of course, there are some. But mostly the women are there because they are related to the central man in some way. And that's their purpose in the plot. They're not there in their own right to run the show, apart from a very few exceptions, like Rosalind in As You Like It, who's the biggest part for a woman. And counting the lines. I didn't personally count the lines. This is from a chart that's out there on the web. And it's it gives all the Shakespeare's roles in order of size, according to the number of lines they have. And in the first 100 parts, there are only 15 women.
Those parts, those women's parts, were played by boys and young men. And you have a fascinating argument about what that allowed Shakespeare to do.
Yes, it's just a theory that if he'd been writing for women, the parts would be more limited. Because I think the boys were allowed to be, they could be a bit, they could deliver a little sexual innuendo. They could be bold and feisty and argumentative and funny and physical in a way that if he'd been writing for lady players, he might have felt. Because he was an audience pleaser, but first and foremost, and it would have been a big jolt to see women on stage, and he'd have to go about it very decorously and delicately, I think. And even when women did come onto the stage some 50 years later, they were always involved in love affairs. You know, they weren't taking big moral decisions or leading armies or doing all the things that we find really dramatic.
So being boys, they could be naughtier.
They could be naughtier.
On stage.
Yeah, I think.
But did it also mean that Shakespeare was dealing with inexperienced actors, beginners? The women were always played by beginners.
Yes, but I think they're very, you know, you look at children now, there are some young actors who, you see these wonderful young actors, don't you?
Yes.
What's humiliating for an old lag like me is that very young people can just get it and do it brilliantly. And
instinctively.
You go, there's nothing I can teach you. You're just brilliant. And why shouldn't that have been true then? But I also think we have to remember that theatre as an art form was pretty young, and it wasn't that London was full of fantastically brilliant actors. There wasn't a pool of, you know, top-grade RSC actors. You know, it was who was free and who was available and who was willing and who had a nice voice. And, people were being trained up in a fairly new profession.
Mm. And you say that Shakespeare takes seriously the possibilities of love between men, but he does not take seriously the possibilities of love between women.
That's right. And again, I'm not blaming Shakespeare because that is just prevalent. And that's prevalent until the last century, really, when people started to admit that there was a thing called lesbianism or, you know, physical love between women. From the male point of view, women couldn't possibly have had sex because they didn't have penises, and therefore, how could they have any pleasure? Because we're the only ones who can give women pleasure.
We're the kings of pleasure, yeah. Yes.
So there was that underlying something, and also that, you know, it was always acceptable for girls to be physically affectionate with one another and touchy-feely with one another. And so when that stepped over into actual mature physical love, it was private and unnoticed, and people, it didn't jump out at people. So I think that, you know, all through Victorian times, there were lots of women living together, but nobody sort of defined it in any way. Nobody even sort of wrote about it or talked about it.
You say of Shakespeare that he teaches actors how to perform his work. How?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to demonstrate that here. But there's something, there are so many ways in which there are clues in the text as to what's going on that it's like you begin to, it's like sort of when you get to know a crossword setter and you start to sort of know what the clues are and what the, how his mind works. You start to understand how his mind works and how, what he's trying to tell you, what he wants you to pick up on. He doesn't do stage directions, but the stage directions are in the language, the way, whether he uses monosyllables, like when, you know, it's just in the rhythm when you say to be or not to be, or if it were done, when t'were done, you know, t'were well, it were done quickly. It's all, it's all the monosyllables that rhythm. Kind of tell you, the rhythm tells you, there's only one way to think this line, really. It's very hard to answer your question without the room. You know, I'd have to sort of do a masterclass on it, really.
Yes. No, look, I just picked it up from the text, this notion that you are safe in his hands. Mm. Yes.
Yes. I mean, one of the examples I've given is that if you're playing Imogen in Cymbeline, which very few people do because it's not a play that's done often, but there's this scene where she is drugged. Everyone thinks she's dead and they lay her in a grave, and right next to her is her decapitated husband, she thinks, another corpse without a head. As it happens, the audience knows that it isn't. It's the decapitated body of the absolute idiot Cloten, who nobody cares about. So nobody's sad about it, but you have to wake up from your woozy sleep, grope around like people do in films when their lover's left and they've got a hollow pillow next to them.
One of the greatest cliches of film.
The big cliche, bed, yes. Where is he? And she gropes around and she finds this horrific thing lying next to her, wearing her husband's clothes. So she presumes she doesn't. It's one of those terrible stretches of disbelief, you know, where she thinks that this is her husband who's dead. And you go, well, what would you do and what would you say? I mean, and in a modern play, I'd have to think of all that and I'd have to act it out and I'd have to, you know, come up with something. But Shakespeare just says, I hope I dream.
Mm. As simple as that.
And he's told me how to do it. That's what I mean.
How is it that we can be on the edge of our chairs, perhaps even on the edge of tears, watching a great performance of Shakespeare, but we know how it ends? How it ends isn't the point. How is that?
I think that's really important because what I've been saying with all of this and the book is that the arias and the music within the play are what I love. The actual plot is often really ridiculous. And, so the plot isn't the thing that matters to us. It probably did to his audiences. The plot was really important, and they, you know, they would recognize all sorts of situations that we don't any longer hold, you know, like the, particularly in the area of relationship of women, where, you know, daughters were totally subservient to their fathers or their husbands. And, you know, we don't buy that anymore, although it still exists. We don't buy it. And in his day, that would have been, you know, quite normal, you know. And we can't take plots like The Taming of the Shrew, and, you know, we just can't swallow them in the way his audiences would have.
Or the Merchant of Venice.
We question all these things now. Whereas in his day, it was a jolly good, ripping good yarn. And within that yarn, he could make, he could create this wonderful poetry. And I don't mean poetry sort of florid language tacked on the top. I mean, you know, gutsy stuff that comes out of you because you're trying to persuade somebody something, or you're trying to threaten somebody, or you're trying to woo somebody, or you're trying to win an argument. There's a real purpose behind the poetry. And, you know, it moves us. I think it's like music. It just, you know, you go, oh, there's that passage I love. Mm. Oh, you've heard it a million times, and you know that it's some very unrealistic opera plot.
But you love,
you know, it just chimes something in your heart, and who knows how that happens. It's a miracle. It's wonderful.
The miracle that is, that happens over and over and over and over again. You talk about the central paradox of live performance. The actor is in one time and place, the character is in another, and the audience is with the character or the actor?
That's a very good question. Yes. I think the audience is with the character, if you're doing your job well. You're trying to take them across time into your predicament, particularly with soliloquies where people appeal to the audience. They say, you know, I draw the example of Isabella in Measure for Measure, leaning out to the audience and saying, to whom should I complain? Did I tell this? Who would believe me?
She's been abused.
And she's been abused. And the audience have seen it. The audience have seen it. And she's saying, who can I talk to about this? And they're crying out, us, tell us, we believe you. But she's saying, I can't come to you. I'm stuck in this play in 16th century Vienna, and I can't shift because this is my plight. And that's the paradox, is that the actor knows that they're actually in the present day and they're going to have supper after the play's over. The audience knows on one level that the actor's going to have supper after the play's over. Mm-hmm. But the whole conspiracy of theatre is that we believe that we're in 16th century Vienna and this woman is being abused. That's the magic of theatre. It's the willing suspension of disbelief.
And you point out that Shakespeare's soliloquies aren't just poetic vaporising, they're arguments.
Yeah. That's so important, I think, because I remember a bunch of sort of young students who were resisting going for the language. You know, they thought it was uncool, and we don't talk like that anymore, and we mumble, and we elide words, and we you know, poetry's unfashionable and sounds silly and unnatural, and they thought of it as decorative and florid, and why say it that way when you could just say, instead of to be or not to be, what that is the question, whether it is nobler in the mind, blah, blah, blah. Why don't they just say, shall I kill myself or shan't I? Full stop.
Yes. Yeah?
They cut to the chase. Well, you'd miss a whole lot of stuff on the way to that. And so I was trying to win them over to the idea that language is that there's an argument going on, even if you're just arguing with yourself in a soliloquy. And that's what gives the whole thing fire and fuel and energy. Is that you're going, I think this, but I also think that. And so even if it's put in a poetic, beautiful way using imagery, the imagery isn't there to show off, look what a clever poet I am.
But to
it's
drive.
It's there to drive you and to move you and to be specific. That's the other thing. So no emotion should be generalized. It should be very specific. Things like that.
Harriet, this has been wonderful. I want you to read what I think is the most beautiful sonnet in the book. And this is your meditation on the tempest, Ariel in the tempest, because it is also the most beautiful meditation on acting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. This is Ariel's sonnet.
By Harriet Walter.
Hattie Walter. Much as an actor hides behind a role, avoiding capture, so I shift my shape. A paradox who's never truly whole, belonging nowhere, longing to escape. I wear a coat of other people's skins, clap on the helmet of my master's thoughts, not sure where his path ends or mine begins, an aerial pet performing somersaults. I zip around the island, flame the sea, dive deep inside the core of spinning earth, paint music in the air where thought is free. But love doth make me ask, what's freedom worth? Unchained from him who loves me, I do fear that loosed to viewless winds, I'll disappear.
I doubt it somehow.
Now, I didn't invent viewless winds, by the way. I'm sure the listener will know that comes from Measure for Measure.
And but, here and there, Shakespeare's own words are given italics.
Yeah.
So there should be no mistakes whatever. But that's very beautiful.
Thank you very much.
Not even beautiful, but just wise.
Thank you.
Harriet, thank you so much for
joining
us on Late Night Live.
Lovely.
You are at the Writers' Festival on Wednesday night.
That's
Is that
right.
correct?
Exactly correct.
Right.
Loving every minute. Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming to Australia for this little gig. I have been talking to Harriet Walter about her new book, her fifth, I believe. She Speaks, What Shakespeare's Women Might Have Said, published absolutely, obviously, by Virago.